pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Women make up 36% of the Habitat organization's workforce and are having a major impact on conservation across the country. In this special Women on the Wing series, we're going to explore their professional journeys, do deep dives into their areas of expertise, and talk about what conservation means to them. I'm your host, Ashley Chance, and in this episode, Britta Peterson and I talk with Dr. Jess McGuire about her work on bobwhite quail and working lands for wildlife. We talk about gopher tortoises, constructing red-cockaded woodpecker condos, snakes in the freezer, and of course, habitat creation in partnership with enthusiastic landowners. Britta, how are things going in Wisconsin?
Hey, Ashley. Things here in Wisconsin are getting green. So it's we had a lot of warm weather and then some rain this last week, so it's greening up pretty fast. But people are still out burning. It's pretty exciting. I've been able to get on some burns myself and been seeing a lot of smoke plumes in the air, so things are happening. So looking good.
Awesome. Yeah, we're green here in Tennessee. It's been that way for a hot minute. Yesterday it was in the 80s. And this episode's going to come out in May. We're recording right now in mid to late April. So, yeah, that was a little premature for me. I'm like, I could wait a bit.
Yeah, I'm such a weenie when it gets really hot. So it's been kind of nice to get outside when it's not quite that warm yet. But like I said, yeah, the burns are... We've had kind of a longer burn season this year, which is nice. So they're ripping off a ton and getting a lot of acres burned between like the NGOs and agencies, staff getting out there and working hard. But we're getting a lot of acres burned, which is exciting.
Yeah, that's good. I think from what I was hearing, it sounded like it was kind of a dry winter. And then at the last minute, you guys got some much needed snow that's kind of facilitating, making it so that you can burn safely.
Yeah, we had it was really dry, so we had a really early burn season. It was kind of like, holy crap, we got to burn, you know, because the conditions were right, like way back in February. And then we did get kind of a brief break with some snow, and now it's kind of, we're getting into that second part of the end of the burn season. But, you know, we got to have that, see if we can knock back some of those cool season grasses and stuff like that now too. So it's all good.
Awesome. Well, today we are lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Jess McGuire down in Georgia. Welcome, Jess.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
When I was writing this script, I was like, down in Georgia. I was like, yeah, everything's north of Georgia pretty much. I guess Florida. Maybe not listeners in Florida. I bet it is hot down there.
Yeah, the minute you walk out the door in the morning, I'm hearing from my six-year-old, I'm hot. I'm like, buddy, you got a long way to go. Yeah, so, but it's good. You know, I can't complain. The birds are, bobwhite are calling outside my porch, so I can sit on the back porch in the morning and hear. So that's, it works for me. I'll take the heat if that's what I hear.
For sure. Yeah, we are going to talk about bobwhite today. Definitely. I think we'll spend a lot of time on that, which I'm excited about. But our first question for you is, what's in your freezer?
What is in my freezer? Well, my 8-year-old's first deer is in my freezer still. We've been working on that.
Yeah.
So he is very proud every time that meat hits the table. It's really cute. And we brought it to Arkansas to, you know, some sausage and stuff for the family. And he made sure to tell everybody, that was my deer. I did that. I provided for the family. So he's good. I think I've got a couple dead animals that need to go up to University of Georgia for necropsy, but you know, helping other researchers out. That's a loaded question in my house, what's in your freezer, because it you know, as a someone that helps universities collect things, it's sometimes there's probably about 50 cicadas in there from last year. Our homegrown,
that's why we asked the question.
Meat. Yeah, we got some homegrown Angus in the freezer, so that's good to have.
I have a question about the research subjects. Can you give us a tally of what they are? I'm interested to know.
So there's a mud snake in there. I still help collect some stuff for a snake fungal disease. In my previous life, I did a lot of disease work. I've got a couple turtles in there, I think, and I think all the birds at this point have been moved out. But yeah, I think that's the tally for now. I honestly, I'm embarrassed. I can't say what's in there.
I mean, freezers really are a little time capsule over the year, mm-hmm. or, you know, sometimes longer down there in the crystallized parts of what's going on in our lives.
We have three of them, so I really try to, keep that stuff separate, but it doesn't always work out that way. I have some duck heads for a project that one day in some life I will get to mounting them, but... Yeah.
Oh, are you going to, put them in beetles and have them cleaned off?
I am, yeah, in little cages, so hopefully I can keep all the tiny parts, all the tiny bones together and glue them together. And I want the skeletal, the skull mounts, because they're just fascinating, the different birds.
They absolutely are. We have three duck heads that, they're probably, 8 years old now, but in grad school there was somebody that had a beetle box for their research, and he let us put them in there and get them cleaned off, and they're these super cool little skeletons. You know, we've got a shoveler, I don't even remember all the other ones, but morphologically they're very diverse. I think one was a wood duck, and we've moved probably four times since then, and so two are still surviving. Our daughter got a hold of one, it was in her arts and crafts drawer for a minute. But I highly recommend to anybody out there that has access to a bug box and a semi-interesting dead animal part. It can be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Kids love it. I mean, that's what I bring if I'm asked to do a program or something at a school. It's bring out the skulls, because you could talk for hours with little kids on that. And the adults, too. They just love it, because no one really realizes, I think, what it looks like. So, yeah, it's lots to be covered when you pull a skull out.
I was gonna say, I'm always jealous of the wildlifers that bring furs and skulls and antlers to our kids' Earth Day or things where we have a bunch of grade school kids coming in, because we always focus on habitat and grass, but I don't know, those kids, even though we try, grass is not and flowers are not quite their thing versus when you get to touch furs and skulls and everything else. So that's some good advice, though, for anybody that's dealing with kids in schools.
Yeah. No, it's the gateway. You got to suck them in and then show them the seed after. Be like, look, this thing ate it. How cool is that? And they're like, yeah, moving on. Show me more dead things.
Yeah.
Yeah, have that otter pelt in your back pocket for them.
There we go.
Jess, you said you've got some homegrown meat in the freezer. Do you all process those animals yourself too? Do you send them out?
No, we don't. We send them to a local butcher. It's really difference in time and the cuts you want and the machines you have to process a cow in a traditional sense. You know, it's not like deer where you can pretty much, quarter it and get things apart. It's a cow's a lot harder, in my opinion. So we trail them up and bring them to the local butcher. And then, a lot of them offer, different things. So like I said, you can get the special cuts, you can get the burger, you can get, the sausage or other things that you want. It's just easier for them to do it. I don't know what I would do if I had all that processing equipment at the house. It's a task, but yeah, we process all our own deer and, it's just different.
Yeah. A cow is a massive animal in comparison to a deer or a sheep or even a pig. I get you there. Okay. So you have a long and I think very interesting history, in terms of your career. You mentioned that you have done a lot of disease work in the past. I know you've worked with some endangered species. Can you kind of tell us how you landed where you are now?
So it was a long run. I feel like, I've been at this for a while now, but really I grew up on a farm, and just wanted to get in the woods. And people that know me know I'm a little kind of like an, you know, introvert unless I have to be otherwise. But, you know, I spent a lot of time in the forest and had teachers that were, you know, teaching us how to observe the woods and measure the woods. So I start measuring trees and doing stuff. So I was kind of just always geared towards nature. So even though we had the farm, it, you know, I just found my time in the woods. And, you know, I wanted to go to college. I was the first in my family to go to college. So, you know, I did play sports, and that kind of helped pay my way through most of school, or some of it. And, you know, having to find that balance. So, you know, I worked at a zoo for a long time to while I was in school, just to keep that experience and to get different experience. So, you know, in the wildlife world, you have to know about animal handling and, you know, how to use darts and things like that. So, you know, it's a lot of people are like, that doesn't connect, but it does. It was pretty good experience. And then through the zoo, I just got to help out on some field activities. So a lot of the zoos and aquariums, they, in order to be certified as with the zoo association, they have to be doing something in conservation. So whether that's paying for it and fundraising for it or actually physically doing it, some of them have hired researchers. So there are lots of opportunities for kids in high schools and like urban settings, or college students that are in urban settings that are in the city, to do that. So I got to jump on some turtle projects, telemetry projects, and some salamander projects. So it just kind of started from there. But because I was so engaged in sports, you know, Britt and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, that you had to find the experience where you could get it, which is why I think it's so broad for some of us that kind of had to piecemeal our way into what we're doing. And you know, some of that led to my grad work, and part of my grad work component was working in the field, but also heavily in the museum. So, you know, getting that world of things, which then led to the interest in disease work, and ultimately my PhD working on gopher tortoise health and management. So that was in the land of in South and the plantations, and that kind of just set it to quail. And in the process of all this, you know, you become more aware of your surroundings, where conservation is happening. I was fortunate to work on a lot of side projects where we were engaging with private landowners, and just realizing that that's really where conservation was happening. And, you know, I would ask, well, why aren't we working with, you know, on a WMA for this? And they're like, well, that's not really where all these animals are. And at the time I was doing bat work. So just that engagement with landowners and teaching them how to conserve bats and dispel myths, I just got really hooked on that kind of management. So it was my goal that any project I took on had real management implications. It's Friday, y'all, you know, speaking this big words. So, you know, being able to stay working with private landowners is eventually how, I guess, my career evolved. And, you know, for a time, like you said, I was, you know, working with gopher tortoise, so they were a candidate species for federal listing, and that's not over yet. I think there's more to see with that. But you know, I also was the state red-cockaded woodpecker biologist. Best, hardest job I've ever had. Super satisfying to be part of a movement that saw a downlisting of a species, and just climbing the trees, you know, putting in those inserts, because for those that don't know, red-cockaded woodpeckers, a lot of throughout their range, there just aren't trees that are old enough for them. They need living trees and usually old longleaf to create their cavities. And since that's not available, we didn't want the species to blink out. So we've literally started climbing trees 20 to 40 feet in the air and chainsawing in cavities and putting in specially made boxes for them to live in, and they readily accept them. It's so bizarre and awesome at the same time. But, you know, we've been able to grow the population that way and really get a management ethic on the ground with these private landowners, that they're really proud of what they've participated in. And it's also led to them not being so scared of the Endangered Species Act and conserving, because, you know, when a lot of times something gets listed, the word gets out, the landowner wants to get rid of it. So being able to flip that script on, hey, don't be scared of it. There's people to help you. This is actually really awesome. It means you're doing something right. And I think that's where a lot of stuff with the, you know, now really focusing on Bob White and the uplands, that's where we're at with the uplands. And I did work for a state agency for a time, and it was great experience, but I really wanted to see that bigger picture and work with multiple states and have states working together. And through my red cockaded woodpecker work, I really got to engage a lot of state agencies and private landowners and NGOs in that way, and I just realized that was a space I wanted to be in. So when Working Lands for Wildlife came along, it was just something that really spoke to where I wanted to be professionally and having an impact on, you know, conservation and the earth and all that good stuff. But I wanted to see it through. And, you know, Quail Forever was kind of leading the charge at that point in applying for funds. And I was even helping with some of that, not ever thinking I would actually leave the state, but I was kind of just facilitating it. But then when it evolved, I saw the position description. I was like, you know what? I was like, can I apply for this? And they were like, yes, yes. Do you want to do that? So it kind of all went from there. And, you know, working with Working Lands for Wildlife and NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service up in D.C. And it's just a mix of everything that I just really enjoy. And that's kind of a long, windy, windy path of how I got where I am. But I think a lot of us in the wildlife field, especially, you know, some women that kind of had to take some hard deviations just to keep moving in the field. You know, there's a lot of us out there that have a lot of this weird experience that all kind of culminates to the skill set that ultimately gets you where you want. You just got to be willing to.
Jess, have you always do it. Have you always had an interest in quail? Going up, even with all those different animals and projects that you worked on, have you always had an interest in the uplands?
Yeah, so birds, even though I've tried to step away from birds multiple times, they just keep coming back professionally for me. And as a kid, you know, on our farm, we actually backed up to a pheasant operation that raised pheasants and then released them on the WMA near us. So I was more familiar with pheasants growing up than I was to other small ground birds. And it wasn't until, you know, probably college where I really kind of started digging into that group. And I got down to Georgia and working on the gopher tortoise project at Itchaway. You know, you kind of have to earn your keep there. It is a working plantation. It does research, but they also are big into, you know, their quail there. And I knew how to ride horses, so I got to go along with a lot of hunts and training, and I just got to see them a lot there and just really fell in love with them at that point. But it was never really a focus until, you know, you just fall in love with the uplands, and the longleaf pine ecosystem is just, you know, the diversity rivals the rainforest, and quail are such a big part of that and such a big part of the culture that's going to save the uplands. So I think that's, they're cute. They're tasty. You know,
they are.
Can you not? What's there not to like about a quail? Really?
Agreed. Speaking of cuteness, for those listeners that maybe don't know, can you give us a rundown on gopher tortoises?
Oh yeah. So they are also very cute. They're one of the strangest animals. They live in burrows deep in the ground. They dig these burrows that are about 30 feet long, 10 feet deep. So they're known as a keystone species, and a lot of species in the landscape actually rely on their burrows. So you'll scope a burrow. We've got these cameras that kind of look like something you'd stick down a sewer, and then you weave it down there, and you'll come across, you know, hundreds of species in an area that you're looking at tortoises. But you know, they're never go in water, even though in Florida they seem to like to throw them back in the ocean. But, you know, they're truly ecosystem engineers. They are very social. They're loyal to their habitat. So they'll have a number of burrows in, you know, let's say 5 acres, there might be 20 burrows. That tortoise will use that same burrow for almost its whole life. I did a lot of telemetry work whereas I was going back on some work that they had done in Auburn 20 years before I had worked on my dissertation, and the same tortoises were in the same burrows, and they used them the same way throughout the year. So they might move burrow to burrow depending on what food source is nearby to which burrow seasonally, but they're really fascinating. You know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just a turtle, they're, you know, not very bright, but they're actually, there's a social hierarchy there. They're really pretty intelligent, and, you know, they head bob to each other. They've got this whole little communication thing that they do with each other, and you know, they're really pleasant to work around. They're just a great species that I really hope that people will pay more attention to them. You know, there's this a new video that came out, Gopher Games, that kind of highlights their plight in Florida and other states. You know, deep decline through a lot of our uplands are with habitat loss and people wanting to develop it. But, you know, they're, like I said, they're a keystone species. Even quail use their burrows. It's kind of like a little air raid shelter for them. Either fire or flying predators, you know? So they're great to work with, and yeah, they were a lot of fun.
That is fascinating. We can definitely link to that video in the show notes. And as you were talking about like head bobbing and all that, I'm like, man, if there's a YouTube channel for gopher tortoises, I'm going to subscribe to it because that feels like something that would be good to include in my day.
You know, and if you Google like gopher tortoise burrow camera, there's a lot of researchers now that are really trying to document usage of their burrows so we can justify, hey, we really need to save these animals. And it is a deep dive, so make sure you have some spare hours, because the photos that they're getting and the videos of all the critters using them, the interactions with the tortoises. I mean, there was one I saw. So spadefoot toads really like to use gopher tortoise burrows, and if you know anything about spadefoot toads, they're explosive breeders, so you get hundreds of them at one time. So they're diving down the burrows, because the burrow, it's a lot like a cave. You go down a certain point, it maintains the same temperature no matter where you are. So it's really good for amphibians. It's humid, it's cool, and there's just this video of a tortoise. So they dig out their burrows with their hind feet, and imagine just sand is flying everywhere. You know, and this particular one, there's just toads flying out everywhere. And the tortoise is just like, get off my lawn, you know, and kicking these toads out everywhere. And what I wouldn't have given to be there at that moment of all my tortoise time. But yeah, so yeah, like I said, we probably squirreled a little bit, but there's lots of footage online to find. And I get sent stuff all the time still. So yeah. So, you know, tortoise That's conservation amazing. Is quail conservation is both. So, you know, we're all in this, and yeah, it's they're fun. As you can tell, I'm very attached to gopher tortoises.
As it sounds like you should be.
Yes.
Yep.
100%.
Yes, everybody should be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tortoise really stickers, fun. Here we come. Yep. Before we move on to quail, which is inevitable, we are going to do that. I am curious, I know from a previous conversation that we had, when you were doing some of this intense woodpecker work, climbing trees, cutting out cavities, you had maybe the person responsible for the deer in your freezer with you during that time, your son. Uh-huh. Is that, can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
The time I didn't know I had him yet? Yeah. So we were
all the above.
Yeah, so that's kind of a funny story. I didn't think I could have kids, you know, so I was just guns blazing career wise and I had climbed hundreds of trees and just didn't feel good one day, and I was like, you know, I don't feel right, maybe I should go, and I won't go into the details, but the swinging of the trees usually never bothered me, and found out I was pregnant, so I just, you know, did what we do in our field, and I'm sure what you're doing. You know, we just keep plugging along, and I worked the trees until my harness wouldn't fit anymore. And I was too pregnant to climb the ladder. But and then, you know, after that, you know, when I had them, it was still at that point, you know, obviously I was far along, still pregnant. When I had him, it was still season, woodpecker season, stuff still needed to be done. So my mom would come out with me at that point, and he'd sit at the bottom of the tree because we were nursing and stuff. But yeah, I don't know if that's the story you wanted, but that's the story you got.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
the kids come out all the time.
Yeah, that's what a gift to be the child of somebody that can provide those experiences that I've never had, probably never will have as a wildlife biologist, and that's pretty awesome.
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people were raising concern about being on the fire line pregnant and being up in the ladder pregnant. They're like, you know, you've got that chainsaw, it's really loud. I'm like, I've talked to my doctor about this. They are so, like, safe in that bubble in us. Like, it's designed to keep them safe from those things. So I promise his hearing is good, although I question it many times if he can really hear because he doesn't listen well. But that's not from the chainsaw. That's just 8-year-old spite. But yeah, they, you know, if anybody's listening, like, you can keep moving on it as long as you physically are able. You know, don't ever push it. Some of us are a little, you know, different, but yeah. So he comes out a lot, and he was dying. Now that he was old enough, that hurricane hit, and some of us that did know how to do it, we had to kind of spring back into action years later, and it was a lot different years later climbing those trees, putting in inserts. But, you know, just bringing your kids out, letting them see that stuff, even if it's just to watch a friend, and I don't care if he goes into engineering later, I want him and both of my kids to grow up with that ethic of understanding the world around them and that they're responsible for it. So, you know, once mommy's done doing whatever I'm doing for it, it's, you know, whatever they do in life, they need to pick it up. So teaching them as much as we can, and maybe they'll go that way, who knows. But yeah.
Yeah, we certainly can't have only wildlife biologists caring about what we're doing, because we won't get it. And yeah, kind of like we were talking yesterday too, it was like when we participated in our college sports, like we get to meet a bunch of different people that, you know, we can educate as we get to share our passions. But I think sharing with kids and people that aren't in our field is what's going to change the world.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I love meeting up with past teammates, and they're like, wait, what are you doing? You know, so glad you asked. Yeah,
those people also seem to be the ones with means to carry out our ideas and schemes.
Yes,
I think 100%. Jess, it was interesting to hear you talk about so much conservation happening on private lands, because I know in our field a lot of times it can feel like, man, private lands are a waste of time because they can change hands and all your hard work can be undone, you know, in the snap of a finger. So it's great to hear that from you and to know that there is so much work being done, with private landowners, especially in the Southeast where most land is privately owned.
Yeah. You know, the hard thing is sticking with it. Like, you know, a lot of people, like when you get to the point of the career where you've been 20, 30 years into this, it's hard, you know, and to see some of those places that you work so hard on and you help plan change hands, and you know, they clear cut it or build something on it or sell it off. And, you know, a lot of stuff around here we see going into solar. It's like, oh, you know, I worked on that for so many years. But then on the other hand, like this morning, I got a call from a landowner that I've been working with for 15 years now. And he's telling me about all his turkeys and all his stuff. And, you know, so that's where, as a professional in this, you kind of have to cling to that, you know, this is a marathon, and you got to take your wins where you can get them, and don't give up on that landowner that you don't think will do anything, because they might come around. You know, it's planting seeds. We can say that, you know, I might not be the one that seals the deal on their conservation values. It might need to be a string of people that come along and interact with that person. So, you know, we're all so busy and we have so many people asking, but you know, those properties that are truly important to the species are people that we can't give up on them. And yes, it's exhausting, but you know, that's what we're tasked with. And if we all keep giving up, we're not going to get anywhere. And it's, you know, we just need to give each other a kick in the pants from time to time and a good little pep talk. And, you know, it never fails when I'm like, oh, I can't do this anymore, I get a phone call. from a landowner or from another biologist sharing stories. And that's why, like, stuff like this is so important that people listen to and get stories and, you know, keep everybody going and hopefully get more people interested in what we're doing. And they realize that it's not just, you know, we're not Animal Planet out here. You know, we're getting stuff done and saving little gopher tortoises and cute quail.
Another great bumper sticker. Hashtag, we're not Animal Planet out here. Love that.
Yeah, don't come at me, Animal Planet. Well, I love Animal
Planet. We like Animal Planet. Yeah.
We do.
We're just not it. Yeah, that was very, very well said, Jess. I very much appreciate you being candid about that and about the experience of being a professional in this realm and how sometimes it can be really emotionally challenging mentally, but to stay in the fight, so to speak, and do what you can.
Yeah. But it was a good point. Like, I think a lot of people get scared about working with private landowners because it's the assumption that they don't like conservation or that we're restricting what they're going to do on their property. And that's not it at all. We're, you know, helping them improve so they get better enjoyment, soil water quality. Like, it's just they're not going to know unless someone talks to them about it.
Yeah, I think that I work with a lot of private landowners too, but one gentleman in particular I can think about is like stereotypical old farmer, if I can say it, like shows up in like jean coveralls, flannel. And when I first met him, I was like, this guy is a grump. Like, he's not going to want to do anything, nothing. But we actually did a little pollinator planting, and this guy is so jazzed about monarch butterflies and bumblebees and all that stuff that, you know, just like you say, you don't know the impact that you're going to have, you know, and especially in some of these more rural areas when you've got a gentleman like this guy that I worked with, you know, if they start talking to their neighbors, I think a lot of conservation gets done that way from, you know, you trust your neighbor potentially. And so that can happen. And plus then you get more habitat in a localized area, you know, and so it's building makes it bigger. So yeah, definitely. You just don't know what the kind of impact you have. So we got to keep trying.
No, for sure. And you hit it right. Like, it is about landowners talking to landowners. You know, we don't have that credibility in the community sometimes, and that's what it takes. But, you know, you show them a few things on their property or show them, you know, even a plant, you know, like a pitcher plant bog, or look, you do have tortoises, and like, you run that camera down and so they can actually see the turtle. You know, they start having their friends come over. And I had one landowner that would start bringing friends over so they could roost the RCWs at night. So the RCWs are very habitual. They come out at the same time in the morning, they go back in at the same time at night. So you can sit and watch them. And he would just get people out there in chairs and they would just sit and put the birds to bed. And I can't even imagine how many people he probably impacted just having over for, you know, a bourbon and bird watching, you know?
Some woodpecker watching.
Yeah. Like, how many people he probably turned on to conservation that way, or at least, you know, got them a little bit excited. So it's, you never know where it's going to come from.
So in talking about landowners, private landowners, I would like us to talk about, what's the acronym? WLWF, Working Lands for Wildlife?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I got the F and
the
W backward.
we talk in so much alphabet soup. Yeah, I'm trying to be better.
That's true.
Yeah, so Working Lands for Wildlife is a range-wide effort for bobwhite specifically, but it's also a national effort on behalf of the USDA, so United States Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, so NRCS, and Farm Service Agency, FSA, are all entwined in implementing this. So basically it's using farm bill programs that we've already had, but really focusing them on working lands for wildlife. So it's exactly what it says. And the goal is to build that trust for both parties on the landscape. So farmers will trust biologists, et cetera, and they'll want to embrace conservation. But, you know, finding that win-win. So I had a mentor often say to me, don't get frustrated. Remember, perfect is the enemy of good. So you want to find ways to engage landowners, and like we've been talking about, get them excited. And that's really what is behind Working Lands for Wildlife, is finding that balance, that win-win for both, that hopefully we get more wins and it tips that scale, and you know, they begin to embrace it, and it's just a normal part of their farming operation. You know, we're not far removed from a time where we didn't have to worry about this on some farms, because the way they were farming just was naturally good for wildlife. And you know, timber was being thinned because it was at a smaller scale. We didn't have to worry about markets. You know, things were just different. So now we're having to get it shifted back and just really teaching people what it was like and how things were implemented, incorporated in the past. So that's really what is behind this. And there's many species nationally, but the bobwhite is specifically in, obviously, the bobwhite range. So about 25 states are involved, and that's where the state NRCS staff really engages with partners like us to implement it in the field. So we've hired a team of biologists, farm bill biologists, the same as QFPF has always done, but they're a little bit more dialed in to the goals of Working Lands for Wildlife, and that's to put more upland habitat on the ground, specifically for bobwhite, pollinators, and other upland birds. And not only does it provide that cost share, but also there's some outcomes assessments and monitoring happening, so we can actually see if what we're doing is resulting in more birds on the ground or more wildlife out there, and just changed ideas. So are they adopting what we're selling, essentially? So that's really just getting the effort focused on conservation with producers.
Jess, can I ask, so as an example, on some of these practices, are you looking at like more rotational grazing, like bird-friendly focused grazing? Is that mm-hmm. something, or what, do you have some examples yeah. of?
Yeah, so, you know, breaking up the fields, you know, into smaller blocks, prescribed fire, getting fire back on the ground, thinning and burning trees. So, you know, a lot of tree stands will border fields, and you kind of forget about the trees that border it. And getting back to managing that, dealing with all the fun invasive species that we've allowed to pop up over the years, because we haven't been burning, we haven't been managing. Just putting in field borders. And, you know, one big part of it, too, is precision agriculture. So there's a reason why I love it. When I go out on a field visit with one of the precision ag biologists, you know, they'll look at a spot and they'll pull out their fancy maps, and you always have like an older generation farmer out there is like, well, we didn't need those fancy maps to tell you why you shouldn't have been farming that. You know, we never farmed it. My grandfather never farmed it. And it's like, well, this group needs to see those maps. And yes, grandpa was right, but you know, some of us are a little more stubborn and like to see the data. So, you know, there's money going into that and focusing on, you know, where we can optimize farming to then also optimize the wildlife. Field borders, I think I said, you know, there's a lot of different practices that are going into it, but, you know, those are pretty much the big ones. And, you know, smarter grazing, native grazing, you know, pushing native plants, you know, making sure our pollinator habitat that we're selling is native pollinator habitat, not, you know, box store seed mix. So doing a lot of stuff like that. And it's also translating science as well. So educating landowners about what they have, which we've already covered how important that is. So it's a lot of different resources all rolled into one program, I guess.
So from the producer side of things, you know, if I'm a landowner, I'm a producer, and I'm interested in seeing what can be done for wildlife on my property without, you know, making me bankrupt or ruining my yep. livelihood, how does one engage with something like Working Lands for Wildlife?
Yeah, so, you know, going to their local NRCS or FSA office, there should be people there that can direct them. And then certainly, you know, our biologists, we have hundreds of biologists throughout the country now. And for Working Lands, I think we're about at 80 or so. So there are a lot of resources out there to find expertise. And, you know, if you just Google Working Lands for Wildlife, Bob White, There's a lot of places that will then direct you, a lot of websites through that that'll direct you where to go get help. And, you know, just reaching out to us at, you know, Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever, we can direct you in the right location as well. But, you know, certainly those field offices know how to get help. And then, you know, right now, another thing we have, is the Bobscapes app. So bobscapes.org, B-O-B-S-C-A-P-E-S.org. That's to document birds. So if you have birds on your property, you can document it there. But you can also ask for technical assistance through that app as well.
What is that? I'm curious what the data generated by that app is. I mean, I can think of ideas that it would be useful to have that data, but who's using that and what's kind of being done with that?
Yeah, so there's no hotspotting involved. The raw data is not publicly displayed anywhere. So I think I knew where you were heading with that is maybe some new hunting spots. But yeah, can't be used for that. There's no way to get that. But the raw data, never. The raw data is actually used for a lot of the modeling exercises that we're doing to try to dial down on where to put conservation on the ground. So really finding good locations, more bang for our buck. And then once we get those areas settled and we're feeling good about it, then we can start working out from those areas. But also, like I said, it's a place to learn. So if you need to brush up on your Bob White calls, we have both all the calls listed on there. So you can listen to it, make sure that's actually what you're hearing. And then you can ask for help. You can ask for technical assistance, or you can ask for help with cost share. There's very specific ways to ask for that. And, you know, data won't get shared with anybody. It's a tight circle that's allowed to have it because it is funded by USDA. So we do have privacy of information that we are adhering very strictly to.
Can I ask a specific quail question? Because it generated one while you were talking. And because I don't know much about quail, you seem like the person to ask.
Maybe.
So you were talking about trying to find locations for, you know, where to put conservation on the ground. How good are quail at kind of reestablishing? Like if you know, we talk about if you build it, they will come. You know, if we have good quail habitat, how good are they at finding it and being able to kind of do their thing once they get into that good habitat?
Yeah, so they are actually pretty good at it. As long as there have been populations that have stayed in the area that can find it, you have a pretty good chance of growing birds on your own place if they're nearby. Like I said, that's why it's so important that we focus in where we know we have birds, and then we can start to move out from there. So they have that, they don't fly far, you know, they're mostly on the ground most of their time. Whenever I see one of the, you know, flushing pictures, you know, that's an alarmed bird. That's not normally what they're spending their time doing. So, you know, building it where you know you have them, you'll get them. It does. Once you open up that canopy, It is fun to see how they move in and then how they'll move around on your property. And we work with a lot of landowners that have documented that through quail counts, so spring and fall counts. We try to do that with our landowners as much as our time allows and working with partners to do that. And we have been able to see where we implement programs, such as there's a lot of good documentation with the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, bunch of studies where it's that same thing. If you build it, they do come. They just need to be nearby. So.
Yep. I just had a landowner this last year. So we historically had a population of Bob Whites in southwest Wisconsin. The first year I was down here, I did a survey for DNR to check. So, like, they're still checking for them and they're still here. Mm-hmm. But I had a landowner just this last winter that had said they put in 50 acres of CRP, which is a pretty good amount for here in southwest Wisconsin, and said over this last growing season that they'd seen some. You know, and so I asked first, you know, any of your neighbors, like, put out birds that you potentially would have seen, you know, stocked birds, and, like, we don't think so. You know, of course, that could be the case, but I think I have heard off and on that there's still little you know, potential sightings of birds, but I don't know.
I saw one in Minnesota.
See, they're okay. Like, so maybe they're here. But yeah, it was exciting. I mean, they were really pumped about it. And again, it was a pretty good chunk. And they have some nice CRP. They worked really hard to keep it, you know, really good habitat and get it established well. And they do. So
yeah, it's exciting. So they need a lot of connectivity. You know, for a small bird, you wouldn't think that they would need much, but they do actually need, you know, potentially thousands of acres of well-managed habitat within the area. But, you know, it can be in pockets. So that mosaic across the landscape, and they can be there, you know. So if they're there year after year, that's why monitoring and paying attention is so important, you know, and then looking for nests. I believe it usually when I hear about a nest or I hear that they've seen, you know, chicks or something, you know, because you never know. There are a lot of birds getting put out, and we all know that they do not do well long term. Right. You know, maybe a few
weeks. I chatted with those landowners specifically to say, hey, let's keep an eyeball on there and see what, if you can see them again this growing season. So definitely we're gonna I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, that's why, like, I don't think sometimes we give some of these critters that we work with enough credit for their resiliency. You know, for what we put them through and habitat we take away, they do hang on. And it's just a matter of us to get our acts together so they can stay that way. But, yeah. They do. They make a way if they're just hanging on.
So just the app that you mentioned, I just want to circle back to that, because what a neat opportunity for citizen science and to make a really tangible and instantaneous contribution to our knowledge and work around quail. That's awesome. Also, it sounds like there's resources that folks can benefit from on there too. We've been talking about quail and we've kind of danced around a lot of the stuff with quail, but you know, there's people listening from all over the country, and when we say quail in this episode, we're definitely talking about northern bobwhites. Can you give us a rundown of just kind of like what the problem is? Like, why is this something that we care about? What's the deal here?
Yeah, so it's like any animal you're talking about these days, you know, it's habitat loss or change in how we manage the habitat, whether it's, you know, in forested systems, we're not thinning and burning anymore, or, you know, in ag systems, we've just become too road to road with ag. You know, we're keeping things too clean now. You don't see a lot of dirty fencing anymore where things have grown up and, you know, are nice, you know, good habitat for birds and other animals. And it's just really, that's what it comes down to is the habitat. I have a lot of people that will be like, well, you know, they're hunted a lot, but research is showing that it's not hunting. You know, there are graphs out there that will put up a suite of other upland species, and you see those other upland species that are not hunted declining just as quickly as bobwhite have. So it's clear, you can make the assumption at that point that it's habitat loss with any animal we're worried about right now. It's that's really the big thing.
And you kind of just touched on this a minute ago, but maybe would you maybe want to talk about why stocking is not the solution, or why putting birds out on the landscape is not the way to go to increase our population?
Yeah, so I mean, half the time where people are stocking, it's still not good habitat, and the birds just don't have that natural instinct anymore. It'd be like, you know, yes, there are some places where there are wild chickens, and a lot of people will cite, well, you know, there's wild chicken populations, but it's just doesn't work that way. You know, there is some evidence that sometimes those stock birds overwinter, but they don't become a good part of the breeding community. So there's genetic studies that have shown that it's the wild birds dominate, and those are the ones that keep reproducing if they're able to. But when you start relying on a band-aid like stocked birds, which you essentially do, if there's any hope of wild birds being there, they're competing for resources that is already limited if you didn't have a good number of birds. So you want to really focus on your wild bird area. And when we do work with a lot of landowners that do release, so they might have part of their property that we know there are wild birds. So we try to encourage them to say, hey, let's leave this half completely wild so they don't interact with your pen birds over here. Let's shape up this habitat where you feel like you have to put pen birds and make it suitable for those wild birds to come in. Now, landowners have different goals out on the landscape, and that's where, you know, the whole conversation about quail, we could go down a long road on why places, you know, manage the way they do for birds. But when you're talking about keeping them persisting on the landscape at huntable levels, you know, it's really not, they just don't survive. You're going to put a lot of money in to keeping them alive, to trapping, you know, when you could just be putting that extra effort into managing habitat and hopefully getting those wild birds. And I know I get way more satisfaction of a wild bird hunt and then a pen reared hunt. You know, the dogs just work differently, the birds fly differently. It's just a completely different experience as a hunter, and then also just watching their behavior. You know, you shouldn't be able to walk up to a quail in the woods, and that's the case. You know, there's just little hamburgers out there in the getting picked off.
Yeah, well said.
They're just not well suited. Yeah, that's a dangerous hole to go down. Rabbit hole. Rabbit trail? Yeah. Gopher hole.
There we go. Gopher tortoise hole.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Okay, so now hopefully everybody's that maybe didn't before has a baseline understanding of the issues surrounding bobwhites and the work that is being done to ameliorate those issues. Okay, Jess, we're winding down. I feel like we could talk to you for a few hours, but that's frowned upon in podcast world.
people don't want to hear me talk for a few hours.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It depends. Is there an aspect of your job, since the focus of this episode is you and your role here with Quail Forever, is there an aspect of your job that has been a challenge that you like to talk about, or one that you really, really love? Or both?
Oh, that's tough. So there's so much about, you know, with Quail Forever, we've been growing really quickly, and it's been fun to be, you know, a part of different aspects of things. So I've been fortunate to have a few different roles, and, you know, my position's kind of evolved over time, the last, I guess, 5 years. And I really like that we're digging in more into science. You know, that is exciting to me as, you know, someone that's a trained scientist. I really like that. But where I really love is, you know, working with the biologists and just mentoring them and, you know, seeing new biologists come through and start working with landowners and see all their frustrations that, you know, we all had when we first got into this, and just working them through it and be like, you know, stick it out. And I just, that's what I really like about, you know, working here, and just all of our partners. We work with a lot of great partners, and that was really the big reason why I wanted to jump over to the nonprofit world, is just being able to work with so many different people, just a diverse group of people that have a common goal, and, you know, multiple states, and it's like a puzzle out there, really, is taking the best. As a NGO, we can take the best things in some states and then try to implement it in another state, and just having that flexibility to be able to do that and see, you know, people grow is what I really enjoy the most. So it's a hard toss up between, you know, keeping my feet in the science realm and keeping my in the delivery realm. That's been kind of a challenge, is which way do I go? I actually had that conversation with someone this morning, so it's kind of funny. But yeah, you know, you can do so many things here.
Yeah, I think that is the eternal struggle, is to, especially when you've been in academia or been involved in research, it's kind of like two sides of the fence. It can feel like a lot of times where you're either an applied scientist or you're out there actually implementing the work.
Yep.
I've known a few people, especially of an older generation, that have been able to keep a foot in both camps through sheer stubbornness, maybe.
Wow.
But yeah, I think that can be. I hear you on that, I guess, because I know you're not alone in that.
It's hard, but you know, that's the other beauty of it, is that we are applying science on the ground, which means we can then say, hey, you know, this isn't quite working. Can we look into this? And, you know, we can actually ask the questions as an organization and then pull the partners together to help us answer that so we can be adaptive in how we, what we do day to day. And that's what's fun about working here is just seeing that, you know, teamwork and those connections be made. And, you know, we're getting into it more and more. So it's, I guess that's what I like about it. It's also what the challenge is too, is, you know, how do I plan my day? It's a mystery.
For all of us.
Can you? Can you?
For all of us. We all have long lists.
Yeah. Okay, so in a similar vein, if you were queen for a day, what would you change to impact conservation?
Oh, boy. Do you want the answer that will get us in trouble or the answer?
We can edit
so,
it.
Yeah, right?
Give it to us. Give it to us real.
Delete. So I would just love to see some of the politics out of it, you know, and us to just truly, like, wake people up and say, look at what is happening in your backyard, or, you know, be able to go to the politicians or the leadership in, you know, our wildlife organizations and be like, you know, put that stuff aside. This is really what's happening. Because a lot of these things we have answers to. We know how to fix this, right? You know, we know where the dollars need to go. But, you know, we're not all trained in conservation and we need to be patient in getting that buy-in and careful how we get that buy-in. So I think if I was going to be queen for a day, it would be forcing everybody into a room that we could share this with them and get them to sign on a line that says, yes, I understand. This is what I've been told. And just so, you know, we know we're reaching them at least for the day, you know, and maybe get some change out of that. But yeah, just getting people to, you know, just our friends too, to know that they're part of this. Like what we do on a daily basis is a part of it. You know, if I get stressed out, someone once said, you know, well, you're not saving the world or anything today. It's like, well, what we do, we actually are. Like, that is exactly what we're trying to do here. You know, if you'd get on board, it'd be a lot easier. So that would be my, yeah, I guess. Does that answer it? I don't even know.
That's good. I like it. Compulsory knowledge and buy-in. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that could be useful in a lot of arenas.
Yes.
I like it. Okay. In closing, we're just going to go around the horn and talk about what's been going on for us recently, our most recent adventure, or maybe what's coming up. We'll start with Britta.
I guess, like I said before, burning is my kind of most recent one. And then officially my turkey season is in a week and a half. So I am really excited. And currently I have about 4 toms that I can see from my couch. So let's hope that they'll stick around during the season. And then I also have a really good landowner friend here that she's a great, passionate landowner, and she lets me hunt on her property, and there's been turkeys there, too. So it's been exciting to see them now, and hopefully they'll stick around.
Very cool. It's a good sign when you can see them from your couch, I think.
I know, right?
I need a couch turkey because I'm not going to make it out this year. I'm just not. It's not on the cards for me. I think a recent adventure that is noteworthy, and I was thinking about this the whole time, Jess, that you were talking about gopher tortoises. We went out as a family on a WMA looking around for morels and whatnot, and my husband spotted a box turtle coming out of, I don't know, is hibernation the technically correct term for what they do? Over the, it was coming out of the ground, and it was all covered in mud that was like slowly drying, and we got to show my daughter, and obviously she didn't understand like the coolness of what we were seeing, but she was still pretty interested. It was pretty neat. I've never seen that before. I found baby turtles that were like, you know, eggs were laid and then like digging in a gravel pit, they've come out, but I've never seen one emerging like that in the moment.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Jess, what about you?
We're baseball season right now, so that's got most of my time, but I'm trying to get that turkey. So our turkey season is in. They torture me every morning when I'm packing the kids up for school. So I'm hoping to quiet one this weekend. So
yeah, get it, girl.
That's the big stuff going on around here. But and then
yeah. I guess I meant to also say my upcoming adventure. By the time this podcast airs, I might be a mother of two rather than one.
Yes, very exciting.
If not shortly, yeah, after. So that's the reason I'm not turkey hunting.
Pretty big adventure. Mm-hmm.
So I'll report.
Maybe
back
you need
on
to
that,
go.
Hopefully.
Maybe you need to go hunting, turkey hunting, and that would get you started. You know,
it's entirely
what a
possible.
Story I'm that just... would be.
I did turkey hunt
into labor with a call in your hand.
I did turkey hunt very pregnant with my daughter, but not this pregnant. I'm like 2.5 weeks out, and I'm just, it's more a question of stamina and physical ability at this point. That's why
a couch turkey
sounds great to me. Yes. If that ends up happening, then I'm in. But oh, thank you, Jess, so much for coming on and talking to us. I learned a lot, and it was great to hear more about your story.
Thanks so much,
Jess.
Thanks for listening. This episode is the last one in our Women on the Wing series. If you enjoyed this series and would like to hear more episodes in a similar vein, let us know. And if you want to support the creation of Upland Bird Habitat, become a member at pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org.